Ben Gallagher is a remarkable individual. After serving in the British Army for over 16 years, his life was turned upside down in 2019 when he was shot numerous times on active duty. Ben would sustain blast and fragmentation injuries to his upper torso and arms as a result of that incident, and without a doubt, his body armour saved his life. What followed was a number of operations and extensive surgery to reconstruct his left arm, while he now also has surgical injuries to both legs. But this was all just the beginning of a long battle. What happened to Ben was utterly traumatic, and along with a long period of rehabilitation, he felt lost, isolated, unable to come to terms with what happened, and he would have suicidal thoughts. Subsequently, he would also be diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Ben's journey and the turnaround since then has been remarkable, and sport has played a key part in that. He can now say he's represented his country at the 2023 Invictus Games, winning gold in the men's IR6 4-minute endurance row and bronze in the men's IRB3 crit cycle race. And another major achievement could be on the horizon, the Paris 2024 Paralympics. Ben's journey in rowing, which began with simply using rowing machines for exercise, has developed into something so much more. He has raced at the British Rowing Indoor Championships, and he is now classified with British Rowing on the GB Para Rowing World Class and Paralympic Academy programme, with reaching those Paris 2024 Games very much the aim. This is all just a snapshot of what Ben has achieved. As you'll hear in this podcast, there has been so much else along the way and plenty of unimaginable battles as a result of what happened to him. But I challenge you to find someone with a more inspiring message than Ben. Ben, a very warm welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us to have a chat in what may proved to be one of our most varied episodes I think we've ever done on this podcast. Firstly, for some context to listeners, we're recording this on December the 10th, 2023, which means yesterday you were taking part in the British Rowing Indoor Championships. How was it ultimately?
Hi as well. Thanks for having me on. It was really good actually. BRIC was a competition that I entered a couple of years ago, and I did it virtually. Had no idea about indoor rowing properly. Indoor rowing was just, an indoor rowing machine was just a piece of equipment that I jumped on in the gym and used as part of a workout, and then entered BRIC, or the British Rowing Indoor Championships, as you mentioned, in 2020, and did pretty well on it, and thought there was a bit of a natural talent there, and decided to sort of investigate a little bit more. So watched many YouTube videos, tried to, you know, sort of swat up on my rowing technique, and then things have progressed since then. But yesterday was really an opportunity for me to do it live at the NEC in Birmingham. It was being held under FitFest UK, which was a big fitness festival that was going on, but British Rowing held the British Rowing Indoor Championships there yesterday. And yesterday was about a bit of profiling with my rowing, and I managed to come away with a gold for the PR3 2000 meter row, and silver in the 1 minute, which is pretty awesome. So really chuffed with that outcome.
And as you should be, certainly sounds like a successful day. And again, as we go on in this show, people kind of get a sense of how important that rowing side is to you, and how it's kind of formed a significant part of your life now. And as I've alluded to in the intro, Paralympics as well, ambitions going on in the future. But in terms of telling your story, rewinding is probably the best place to kind of start. And as I said, listeners will have had a brief summary in the intro to this about the life-changing incident that you went through in 2019 while on active duty with the British Army. But taking it back a little bit before that first, and you joined the army at, I think, the age of 17.
Yeah.
Serving over 16 years in the end. At that point in your life when you're joining, why was the army the route for you then? And I suppose how did it shape you in as a person?
Yeah, so yeah, you're right. I joined the army in 2005, age 17, and I think it was quite a weird time. I was working as a heating and plumbing engineer at the time. Wasn't sure what I wanted to do, what direction I wanted to take. I didn't actually enjoy school. School was quite difficult. I was a very kinesthetic person, so very hands-on, practical learner. So all those kind of lessons I did well at. Lessons like English and maths, I passed my exams. I think I got D's, C's and D's. But I didn't enjoy those lessons. I was a very practical person. Like I said, then I left the military, left school, joined the army cadets. I was part of the army cadets, and was like very focused on the military, but wasn't sure whether that was the route for me at the time. Became a heating and plumbing engineer for a little bit, and then the guy that owned the business moved overseas, and I was just sort of pondering what to do next, and I wasn't quite sure. Quite a few of my friends who I grew up with had gone on to join the military and been quite successful with promotions and deployments and time away, and they always came back and said how much they enjoyed it. So I sat down with a couple of them one of the days, as a sort of 17, 16-year-old, and said, what should I do? What should I join? And a lot of them had joined the infantry, and they said, look, don't join the infantry. Go and get yourself a trade, something that you can build up whilst you're in the military, and then you can come out and potentially use on civilian street later down the line when you decide to leave. So I went away, went to the Army Careers Office in Birmingham. Carried out something called a BARB test, which is British Army Recruit Battery, which is a online test which gives you a set of scores. And this set of scores, basically, the test is a number of different formats, and the test basically identifies a score, and that score gives you a list of jobs that you can do within the military. And it was quite a practical, although it was like virtual, like on a computer. It was quite a practical test, so it was a lot of thinking, a lot of practical, like quizzy kind of tests. And I scored quite highly. I did quite well, and I had a whole list of jobs that I could join in the military. And I'd also done a GNVQ in ICT at school, so I was quite computer literate. I liked computers, and one of the jobs on there was a job within the Royal Corps of Signals as a communications and radio specialist. And I thought, oh, that sounds good. It sounds practical. It sounds hands-on. It's a technical trade. It's something that's probably going to ever sort of develop and move forward. And I'd done GenVQ ICT at school, so I thought it'd be great to continue that on. So I then applied for the military, and to join the Royal Corps of Signals as a comms and radio specialist, and did so. And that's what led me to sort of move forward with my military career. Like I said, joined the army in 2005. Did basic training in Lichfield, which is not too far outside of Birmingham, and then went on to do my trade training. So, your comms specific training, down in Blandford in Dorset, which is the home of the Royal Corps of Signals. I was there for probably about 6 months till sort of mid 2006-ish, April 2006. So yeah, that completed all my training, and then I went on to sort of join the field service, or the field army then, and then had a career within the Royal Corps of Signals as a communication specialist. I mean, in terms of like the job and the career, that I literally did what the military sells itself to do. That you used to travel the world, do all these courses, sports and adventurous training, all those kinds of things. I literally, at every opportunity, I did embrace the military and embraced what the military had to offer. And it really shaped me as a person, because it was all practical, it was all hands-on. So I did thrive quite a lot within the military. I promoted quite quickly. I moved around quite a bit. I did a number of operational tours. And I was always looking for that next thrill, that next course to complete, that next thing to add, that next string to add to my bow, sort of thing. I was always looking for that next thing. So yeah, quite a successful military career, but that's sort of where it led me to and the road it led me down, really.
Yeah. Does that kind of summarize you up a little bit as well, in that kind of always looking for that next task, that next achievement, that next thing to aim for?
Yeah, I like to be kept busy. So I always like to, and I've sort of probably more formalized it a little bit now in my life, where I like to have three things. Don't know if you want to call them goals or, you know, achievements to look forward to, or, you know, however you want to. I just like to have three things to look forward to. One in the near future, sort of one in the middle future, sort of a year, 18 months down the line. And then one in the long term. So, you know, a couple of years time, I'd like to do X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to have a couple of little goals, achievements that I'd like to aim for. And that's probably, that was probably enforced through my military career, because you always have to do promotion courses. You're promoted or posted onto a new unit every few years. So there's always them natural milestones that you reach for your military career. And that's probably bred into me a little bit through those 16 years, where now I've probably, like I said, formalized it a little bit and made it a bit more practical for sort of now life. But yeah, to have those goals and those milestones to look forward to and achieve. And they don't have to be extravagant. They don't have to be big. Just things to look forward to and things to keep focus and direction, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I don't know if it's kind of fair to say if it was kind of an all-encompassing part of your life, where, you know, the military can be such a dominant factor in your life and that becomes the main part of it, and I suppose a large part of your identity and how you kind of look at yourself and categorize yourself, and whether that was, I suppose, what you had in those 16 years as well, where you are, you know, like the military man kind of thing.
Yeah, no, definitely. It does make you, some people use the word institutionalized. It does sort of make you a bit, it gives you a name, it gives you a branding, it gives you a bit of who you are. And a lot of people don't like the military. A lot of people join and leave quite soon after joining. But for those that stay in longer, yeah, it does, you know, it institutionalizes you and makes you who you are. A lot, you know, often changes your personality, it changes who you are as a person. And I was married at the time whilst I was in the military, and it did affect my married life as well, because I was away quite a lot. I had young children. So again, that was part of a balance that was quite difficult during military time, because I was so career focused and career driven, that would often affect my family life. And it did get to the point where obviously it caused separation between me and my ex-wife, where, you know, the military was, it is a busy sort of career, really. It takes you all over the world. And unfortunately, there's a lot of the time where you can't say no. You have to commit to going away, and you have to be, you know, you have to be ready to go away. But yeah, it does make you who you are. It does make you, it's quite a hard question to answer, actually. But yeah, it makes you who you are. Mm. It gives you, you know, you're always answering to a set of rules and, you know, punctuality. You always have to be dressed smart. Like all of that kind of stuff over a period of time does take its toll, and it does impact you. Only for the right things, you know. You look at industry nowadays, and industry openly look for people that have a military career because they want people that are punctual, that are going to turn up to work smart and on time, and, you know, going to carry out the jobs and the tasks correctly to the best of their abilities. So yeah, I totally understand why industry now, you know, actively employ ex-military personnel.
Yeah, like I say, those practices getting ingrained into you as a person. Yeah. And to quickly bring sport into it as well, and kind of the cross parallels, if you like, where if you're a professional athlete or elite athlete, so much time is spent training and so much time is spent being the best that you can be, but then balancing that out with normal life.
Yeah.
That's often the challenge for a lot of athletes. And I presume that now you can kind of draw on those early experiences and learn those lessons, if you like, for what you're doing now.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. There's a lot, I've chatted to a lot of, you know, professional athletes over the years, from you know, England rugby players to obviously para rowers and Olympic rowers nowadays. And yeah, there's so many crossovers with the way military life works and sporting life works, but also the impact it has on your life as a person and as a sports person, but also the team cohesion and the banter and the comradeship and the humor and humility that you all connect with through that common ground that you all have through sport or through the military. It's very similar. So yeah, it does. And but like sport in the military is slightly different in the fact that actually sport, a lot of people do sport in the military, not just because they enjoy the sport that they're doing, but it also gives them an opportunity to take off the green kit and put some sporting kit on and go and do something slightly different from their day job. So it's a, mm-hmm. it's a slightly different context to, you know, I suppose elite sports or team sports, you know, out in civilian street. But sports in the military is more an opportunity to still represent your country, but also to take off your uniform and put another uniform on that's not your day-to-day, in a way, I suppose.
Mm. And still have an element of pride wearing it as well.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
So 2019, and that's when, I suppose, your life ultimately changes, when it all changes, and that's when you're shot numerous times whilst you're on active duty. Do you want to just take us through kind of that incident and I suppose the subsequent impact that it obviously has on you, which is substantial?
So like you say, whilst on active duty in January 2019, I received multiple gunshot wounds to my upper torso and both arms. And I also received sort of blast and fragmentation injuries across my chest. You know, quite a devastating day. I call it a bad day at the office, quite literally. But yeah, that changed my life really. So I got injured. Obviously, then got evacuated and went through hospital. I had 6 major surgeries in total whilst I was in hospital. 5 within the first week. The first 4 were to debride my wounds and stabilize me, just to make sure, you know, I was good basically, and I was going to move forward. And then exactly 1 week later, on the Friday, I went in for reconstructive surgery, and I had my left arm completely reconstructed from the elbow down. And that was a combination of tendon, nerve, and skin grafts from other parts of my body. I had no injuries below the waist, but due to the surgeons being absolutely amazing, and they have to take something from somewhere in order to, you know, keep my limb and to keep me going, they took parts from my legs to reconstruct my left arm. So yeah, 5th surgery, exactly a week later, came out of surgery with my arm still attached. And I say that because I was going to go into surgery, and there was a likely chance that my arm was going to be amputated above the elbow, due to just the nature of the injuries and the impacts that I'd taken through my left arm. And then what followed was probably about just over 5 weeks in hospital. So clearly the first week was, I can't remember really much of it. Then after the major reconstructive surgery, I think I was in surgery for about 14 hours where they reconstructed my arm. And then that really followed was a period of sort of learning to use my hand again, getting up out of bed, you know, the general stuff that you would do in hospital, regardless of what impact of injury you'd have, you'd sort of go through that recovery process before you're then discharged from hospital to go home. And that process for me lasted about 4 weeks. So I was in hospital for just over 5.5 weeks in total. I then left hospital and went on full-time rehabilitation, which was pretty much Monday to Friday, 8 to 5 every day for about 8 months. I left hospital with probably about 3% function in my hand. So my hand was sort of fixed in this position and I had a little bit of finger movement, but that was about it. And then over the course of that 8-month period, that full-time rehab, I learned to grip and hold again. You know, use my tendons that had been moved around in my arm to aid them and strengthen them. I had soft tissue work, which helped with the blood flow because I only had one artery left in my arm. And then I did a number of other gym-based physical activities to keep me fit and healthy, but also to aid my recovery and to keep me fit. After that 8 month period, was probably about November-ish 2020. 2019. I was then in a position where you go two ways once you've been through complex trauma in the military or major adversity. You either look to stay in the military, and if your injuries are of a you know, stable condition that you can stay in the military, you go down that fork and they look at keeping you in the military and reintegrating you back into military life. Or you take the other fork, and that's you get to a position where you can't rehab anymore, and you're not taking, you don't require it anymore, I think is the best way to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
So you've reached the limit of your rehabilitation, and then they look to medically discharge you out of the military. So that November point was, I did something called a GROW program, which was a gradual return of work with an occupational health nurse, which was an opportunity for me to test going back to work. And this is done over a 3 month period. So between November and the end of January 2020, I did a GROW program and I tried to return back to work over that period. And it was fairly positive majority of the time, but I wasn't able to fully test being a communicator again and being in my previous role within the British Army. So some of it was positive, but there was a lot of negatives within there. So then at the end of January, I got upgraded again to try and continue to return to work and go back to a job under a military medical grading, which allowed me to progress further and to try and continue that return to work. I deployed away on exercise, and unfortunately I had a massive breakdown. I was fatigued, I was tired, my injuries were sore and painful. I just couldn't do the things that I used to be able to do. And then all of this physical element was also working up on the mental side of things as well. And I was mentally broken, constantly asking myself, why me? I just want to go back to work. I've put all this effort in over this 8 month period of rehab to return to be the person, the soldier that I was before, and I can't do this. Also fortunate at the same time was we were just about to go into a lockdown. So at the end of sort of mid-February time was when all this was going on. And then was obviously teetering on the side of a lockdown coming in. I managed to return home from the exercise, and that's when it really hit me. It really hit me that I couldn't be the soldier that I was before. I've come home because I'm broken. I'm not fully fixed. I can't return to work. And then it just spiraled. When you're in that really down, horrible place, it just really spirals out of control. And there was a lot of other things going on. I wasn't able to see my children. There was difficulties with my ex-wife. And things weren't just moving forward. Things had just become almost stalemate. I was sat at home on sick leave, nothing to look forward to, nothing to get involved in. And on the 10th of February, I decided to try and take my own life. So all of that had just accumulated. I didn't want to share it with anyone. I didn't want to talk about it. I didn't want to express what I was going through because I just felt like I was being a burden to people. And I didn't want to share what I was going through because partly I thought it was going to jeopardize me returning to work and going back to work. When in fact, actually, if I'd had opened my mouth months before and a lot sooner, I probably would have been in a better position and probably would have been able to work, a lot sooner. So yeah, so that all accumulated and really took its toll on me, and I really got down in the dumps. So yeah, was given yet another opportunity after being shot numerous times and then trying to take my own life. I was given another opportunity, and I woke up the next day where I really then sort of with my current partner sat at the side of my bed crying, really broken, but understood that I needed to do something to change. I was better than this. I had more to give. Military was just a job. And I could move forward and hopefully be positive again and you know, hopefully get to a day like today where I can talk about what I've been through and hopefully help others during that process. And so then I reached out to occupational health nurse, clinical psychologist, clinical mental health nurse, and like a number of other people, occupational therapists. There was a number of people that I had within my arsenal of people that I had available to go and talk to and get help from. So I did. I put my hand up and I said, look, I'm sorry that I haven't been telling you the truth over the last few months. I've really been struggling to the point where a couple of days ago I tried to take my own life, and I need help. And clearly I was very emotional and very broken, but then I managed to get the support and help that I needed to allow me to recover a bit better. And then I'll skip forward a little bit. So I had I was diagnosed with PTSD in August of 2020, alongside anxiety and depression. I obviously spent some time with the right people, where I did EMDR and CBT treatment, which is EMDR's like eye movement treatment, which allows you to process your brain, and CBT's cognitive behavioral therapy, where you basically sit and talk, and you talk to someone that you don't know, someone that's got, you know, no bias against you. They're not prejudiced. They're not going to hold you against anything. They're not going to, you know, hang you out to dry. They're not going to share your stories to the newspaper, and they're not going to mock you, and they're not going to humiliate you in any way. And it's just a real opportunity to get everything off your chest about what you've been feeling, what you've been going through, and reason with it and process it properly, and give you some sort of a bit more of a natural understanding as to actually you're feeling like this because it's normal to feel like this. You've been through a lot, and you're going to have a mental reaction to it, and this is why. You're probably feeling worse than what you should be feeling because you've bottled it up for so long. So then got diagnosed in August 2020 with PTSD, anxiety and depression, and really got the treatment that I needed. Unfortunately, though, in the military's eyes, you're then definitely not fit for military service once you've got PTSD on your records. So in February 2021, I sat a medical board where they told me I was no longer fit for military service, and was subsequently medically discharged in October 2021. So, but that really gave me, so from diagnosis of PTSD to sit in a medical board to tell me that I was no longer fit for military service. Actually, those statements sound quite negative, but in my head at the time, they were really quite, I wouldn't call them positive, but they were steps moving forward. I wasn't taking steps backwards. It was an opportunity for me to process what was going on. It was an opportunity for me to understand that I was feeling the way I was feeling, and I now had a diagnosis and a process to move forward. And I used that to leverage my time whilst I was still on sick leave, awaiting medical discharge, to sort of pursue and move forward, really.
Yeah. I don't know if freeing is the right word, a little bit. Like, you've almost got, I say, with a PTSD diagnosis, for example, is you've got it there in black and white. Like,
yeah,
it's not your mind going round and round saying what's wrong. And I imagine that must really be a big step forward. Obviously, not anything anybody wants, of course, but just to see it there as an actual thing must be, like you say, a big step forward.
Yeah, no, yeah, definitely. And all just to process and understand it. And it's not just, oh, you've got PTSD, here's your label, you know, we stick it on your med records. It's, we get to that point because we've talked about all the previous operational tours I've been on, all the stuff I've seen whilst I was on tour that I just dealt with. And then obviously the trauma of the incident that I was involved in, and what fell out from there. And it's just putting that lid on top of the bottle to go, this is all the stuff that's spilling over the bottle, and this is why you're dealing with it, but this is why you're dealing with it. And that helped process that and helped empty a bit of the bottle out a little bit and clean it up and make it a bit tidier and process it a bit better, really.
So, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, first off as well, considering relatively little time has passed since all of that. I think it's remarkable that you're able to talk about it in the way that you are, for starters. And like you say, testament to the surgeons and all the people that were looking after you as well on this journey. And I suppose that kind of bottling up, like you say, was that what we often talk about, the stigma that is men's mental health and not letting those feelings out. And I'm a huge advocate for people doing things like cognitive behavioral therapy, because it does open up a world that I think a lot of people are conditioned, a lot of men in particular, are conditioned to put that aside, park it away. But as you know, as a lot of people know, that's never the solution going forwards, because it is going to fill up overall. I'm not sure if that's something that you perhaps felt like, almost that pressure, just because of what society conditions you into feeling, that that was something that you felt like you had to put away. And now that you're in the position that you are in, I suppose you really want to share that message that, like I say, opening up, really delving in, unpicking those feelings is the best way forward for a lot of people, whether it's a situation as severe as yours or anything else it might be.
Yeah, no, definitely it is. And that's what I do when I talk to a lot of people now, and I do a lot of talks. It is, talking is so important. I've alluded to a couple of them already, but I didn't talk for a couple of reasons. One, because I was so focused on trying to return to my previous job, my previous role, that I thought that would jeopardize it. So I didn't want to share that information. So I was trying to hold it in. I didn't want to share that information with family and friends, when actually it was probably the worst thing to do. I was an alpha male, you know, at the top of my game in the military. I didn't want to jeopardize my position and who I was as a person by this talking about mental health. What's that all about? You know, and actually, when I look back, I was doing so many of the wrong things. And actually, by talking sooner, by allowing my loved ones, friends and family around me to understand what I was going through, I would have had, I wouldn't say more support there, but they would have understood what I was going through better. I would have got help and treatment sooner. So I would never have got as deep and as down as, probably not, you know, to a suicidal attempt, as what I did, because I would have got it off my chest sooner. And actually, CBT, and CBT is the clinical term. It doesn't have to be a clinical process. It could just be talking to friends and family. Mm-hmm. It could be talking to some random person that you meet on the train that you have a connection with. CBT is the clinical term, but actually it's just a talking process, and it allows you to reason with somebody else. And it doesn't necessarily matter who that other person is, what you're going through, and it allows that other person to come back to you with a statement of, actually, does it really matter, or is it really important to you, or can you go and get help, because maybe you're drinking too much, or maybe, I don't know, there's a whole raft of things that we could go through. But you know, do you need to be reliant on that, or, you know, there's so many comeback questions that then could go, actually, yeah, maybe I am, let's say, I was drinking a lot of whiskey, a lot of alcohol. Maybe I am drinking too much. Maybe there's other ways that I could, you know, deal with this and make myself better, rather than numbing the pain with alcohol and overdosing on medication. Or actually just someone reasons with you and goes, do you know what? You can have a bad day. We're all normal. We're all human beings. We're allowed to have a bad day. It's normal. But don't let that bad day continue. So if the bad day runs into tomorrow or this afternoon, then maybe you should have a think about doing something about it. Take a step back from work. Maybe take a bit of time out from, I don't know, whatever activities you've got this evening. Have a bit of time to yourself to reflect, write some things down, see where you are. Maybe reach out for some help and support. You know, there's so many charities out there to support us through mental health. And it's still horrible to read and hear that, you know, the biggest suicide rates are in young males, just because we can't think we can talk to people, and it is horrible. you know, I've lost friends through suicide, through military and civilian life, where often you just don't think there's nothing going on, there's nothing wrong. And I could have been one of those people. But yeah, it's important. It's important to talk. It's important to share what we're going through. And actually, probably people will respect you more by coming forward and talking rather than trying to hide it, because people understand you better. People will connect with you better. People are there to help and support you at the end of the day. We are social beings. We don't work well individually. We're not soul predators, I suppose you could call it. We are very social beings, and we work well around other people. So yeah, definitely talking is a massive thing that I you know, encourage anyone to do. But even if you're not struggling, even if you're literally just having a bad day, you've got out of bed the wrong side, you've had a bit of a rush morning, you didn't get your cup of tea, you know, everything's good apart from this scenario. You start driving to work and someone cuts you off, you nearly have a car crash, everything's still good, you're not, you know, you get to work and you're a bit grumpy. Just to take 5 minutes out with a work colleague and go and have your cup of tea that you've missed and go, damn, I've had such a crap morning. I got up late. I missed my cup of tea. Some idiot nearly drove into me at the roundabout. Just by having that conversation and get it off your chest, within probably 30 seconds, the conversation will go, oh, so what are you up to this weekend? Oh, yeah, I've got a football match on Sunday morning and blah, blah, blah. And then you feel so much better because you've talked about it and you've got it off your chest.
Yeah.
And that goes the same for those small things, but also, like I say, you don't have to go through the adversity that I went through and all the things that I dealt with during the time that I got shot. But it's in comparison for you and what you're going through on that day. So, yeah. Talking is massively, massively important.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I say, tiny little things can make the biggest difference. And I mean, people listening to your story as well, don't do much date maths, if you want to call it that, in your head to work out the world is going through a pretty traumatic time in itself at that period. Lockdowns, like you say, not knowing what restrictions are going to come in at what point. And I suppose you almost having to deal with that at the same time as going through your own thing, that must have been a challenge in itself. And I don't know if it perhaps contributed into you keeping some of those thoughts to yourself, because everyone's going through something of their own at that stage.
Yeah, it was a little bit, but I actually really enjoyed lockdown. And purely because it was the fact that I knew everyone was out of work. I knew everyone was at home to some degree. But it really gave me an opportunity to work. I did some work with an occupational therapist. And once I got to the point I talked and I'd opened up about what I was going through, it really gave me an opportunity to focus on getting my routine back again, getting back into fitness. I had nothing else to worry about. It was just me and my process. And obviously my partner, Kate, was there to go through with me and support me. But we had an amazing lockdown. Like, we'd train every day. We'd get out when we had the hour's break to go out for a walk or whatever it was. You could go for an hour's exercise. We'd get out in the countryside and go for a walk. I did some studying. There was low. I started to get my life back again. And actually, by having the lockdown there, yes, it was difficult. And I did some help. I did some help in the local community as well, and supported some people that struggled to get outdoors, some elderly people. But that really gave me a bit of sense of purpose and a bit of connectivity back into the community again. But it was also really good to just structure my life again. Right, I'm going to go to bed at 10:30. I'm going to get up. I'll read a book and go through my nighttime routine. I'm going to be asleep by 11. My alarm's going to go off at 7:00 in the morning. Right, that's my nighttime structure sorted again, because I didn't have a structure. My structure had gone out the window, my routine. During the day, I got back into having 3 meals a day, you know, training, exercising, doing a bit of studying. So it really gave me that opportunity to focus and sort of delve into my routine again and start to sort that out. Don't get me wrong, it was still difficult. It was still hard not to go out and visit people and see family and friends, and the you know, the prospects of how long it was going to last for, and all that kind of stuff. But when you divulge into, you know, me and my process that I was going on, it was really good and really gave me the opportunity to focus on, you know, what I needed to do to get myself fit and healthy again and move forward, rather than staying at home on sick leave, not knowing what the future holds. You know, that that those two phrases, that context, one was, you know, I can really focus on what I'm doing, where I want to be, what I want to do moving forward, get my life routine back. They're all positives, instead of I'm going to sit at home on sick leave, not know what the future prospects holds. I'm going to get medically discharged. And I had loads of other things going through my head, was, you know, am I going to be homeless? And am I going to be on the streets? What work am I going to do in the future? I've lost my military career. The whole raft of things. So yeah, a bit of a, it was a struggle, but it was a, an opportunity for me to really focus on me again, really, post-injury.
Mm-hmm. To touch on identity again as well, and obviously partly why I asked the question at the start about that army identity that you had beforehand, and obviously what happens, and you're faced with that, say, fork in the road of continuing that career, going down another road, and then eventually being medically discharged. Was that something that was tough to come to terms with as well, that what has been your life for 16 years, over 16 years, suddenly it's, what is it now? What's it going to be? And I imagine that's another tough part to come to terms with, because that's the unknown. That's the future that is undetermined at this stage.
Yeah, definitely. I was a career person. I was in for a full military career. I had the next few years planned out of what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go. And obviously the incident stopped all that and put it on hold, or stopped it, or didn't even put it on hold. So yeah, part of the, again, part of that process of, you know, the PTSD lid on the bottle, allowing me to process what was in the bottle, moving forward. Also part of that process was the identity side of things. Well, at the end of the day, I'm still a military person. I've spent just over 16 years at the time for Queen and Country. And that's still part of me, but that's not the be all and end all. And this is part of the process that I got into through a lot of the CBT that I did, through a lot of the talking and the processing that I did through post-diagnosis, was actually, is the military the be all and end all? Do I need the military? Do I need to really focus on being the soldier that I used to be? Or have I got opportunities elsewhere? Can I go and learn something new? Can I go and try something new? Can I go and start a new career somewhere else? So when I started to be more positive after dealing with everything that I've been through and putting myself on a more positive road, actually then more positive processing started to happen. And I was like, actually, yeah, I am. You know, I've served a good career. I've had a good career in the military. That is still part of me, because that's led me to where I am today. But that's just another chapter. You know, I'm now moving on to the next chapter. And what does that next chapter look like? So although that was part of the difficulty probably before I went through all my treatment and therapy, that was definitely something that helped process moving forward, because I could go, yeah, that was my identity, but that's no longer my identity. So what, you know, that's then gave me the opportunity to go, what do I want to do next? And the excitement of looking forward and moving forward, rather than constantly looking back and going, well, that's what I should have been doing. That's what I should be, rather than going, that's where I could be going. And that's what I want to do. And that's what I want to look forward to. So yeah, that mindset switch, was really important.
Yeah. Are there any kind of things that you class as the really big important lessons that you took away from that recovery period that have, I suppose, made you a stronger person now off the back of it?
To be honest, not being so like hard up about everything all the time. So this is one thing I have learned, more so being, you know, in the process that I'm in today, rather than my military career and going through what I went through, was everything happens for a reason. Everything in life happens for a reason. but life is limitless. Like, it's down to you to choose the path. And if you're having a bad time doing something, stop what you're doing and change it and do something else. Or if something's not working for you, stop it, change it, do something different. You don't have to keep grinding away at something that's not working for you, or that's negative, that's making you unhappy, that's, you know, this is definitely something I've learned more today. And I've definitely got in the mindset that if I'm doing something and I don't enjoy it, and I don't like it, or it's not something that I want to be doing, or whatever, obviously within reason, there's certain reasons, but why would I continue doing it? And then that's what I'm sharing a lot with other people now is, and a lot of people go, oh, I'm in a mundane 9-to-5 job that's boring, come home every night, I go through the same routine, like my partner's unhappy because I come home grumpy and moody, like we don't get any time together, blah, 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 X, Y, and Z. And it goes through this vicious cycle. And actually, probably looking back at my military life, that was probably me a few years before I got injured, that, you know, that I could have made changes. And yes, I enjoyed military life, but there was things within that that I could have made my life a lot better. So I say to people today, well, change it then. Anything in life can be changed, but it comes down to you as an individual to change it. So guess what? Sit down, think about it, and change it, because it's only you that can do that. So yeah, one of the biggest things I've learned is being more being more straight up about things and being more straightforward about things and going. It's like a lot of my friends are doing a lot of educational stuff. They're doing degrees and, you know, lots of online learning and courses and all that kind of stuff. And I have a look at course. I'm like, oh yeah, I might do a course. And then you sort of look into it, and I'm like, why would I put myself through a 3-year master's degree or a 3-year part-time master's degree when, for starters, I'm probably not going to need it. I'm going to spend a lot of time stressing doing work for something that I'm probably not going to use at the end of it. It's going to cost me a fortune. I'm not going to be happy through the process, and on and on and on, when actually I can continue moving forward. And actually, if it comes to the day when I'm like, I'm in a job and I need this master's or this course or whatever it might be to move forward in my job, then so be it, I'll do it and I'll commit to it then, because I know what the positives are for. But I'm not just going to go out of my way to commit to a course or some form of learning that's going to cost me money, make me unhappy, probably not be worth it, waste my time. I'd rather utilize my time doing something more beneficial or helping and supporting other people. That might sound quite, I don't know, that might come across in quite a, I don't know how to phrase it, but in quite a, like, not a negative way, but, you know, but that's what I've learned for myself basically since my injury. Is like, life is too short. You don't know what's around the corner. Or in my case, you don't know what's through the other side of the doorway. But you just can't live your life, you know, chasing things for the sake of it's easy. Or and that's another thing I said about us being social beings earlier. We're also quite wired to take the easy option as human beings. And people will stay in a rut. People will stay in their 9-to-5 job, coming home, doing the same routine day in, day out, moaning they haven't got time for exercise. They don't spend time with their partners or whatever it may be. But that's their choice. They, you know, people are quick to blame other people as well. But ultimately that's their choice, and it's down to them to make that change. You know, there's plenty of jobs out there. There's plenty of other opportunities out there. And it just takes you to realize that you can be better elsewhere, or you can do something else that's going to make you happy. That's one of the big things I've learned.
Yeah, and goes into your mantra that I think is on your website as well, about just ultimately making the most of life. And I mean, looking at your itinerary over the last couple of years, it must be the most packed around. As a quick summary for people, you participated in the 2023 Invictus Games as one. That was in September this year. Picking up a gold medal in the men's IR6 4-minute endurance indoor rowing along the way. as well as a bronze in the men's IRB3 crit cycle. That's just some of it, but you've been a part of the Armed Forces Para Snow Sports team, completed the Marathon de Sable in 2022. That's no mean feat at all. There was Kayak for Heroes in June 2021, where you and a team of injured veterans paddled the Challenge of Land's End to John O'Groats. That's 1,400 kilometres, by the way. And looking ahead, like you mentioned, you're having your three goals, and I suppose that the Explorer's Grand Slam, that's the North Pole, the South Pole, for those who don't know, as well as the highest peak in each of the seven continents. And there's a small matter of being on the GB Para Rowing Pathway with the hope of making Paris 2024, the Paralympics, which will quickly be upon us, I'm sure, since time seems to go quicker all the time. Obviously, that is a pretty good way of making the most of life, just that list there. And I think also kind of reading your background as well, sport, fitness, activity is such a key part of your life as well, before and after 2019. I think you qualified as a personal trainer as well during your military career. It sounds like a simple question, but it can sometimes be really deep. It's just, can you summarize how important that part of your life is, that sport, keeping healthy, and again, how it's become part of you, and now it's very much this next chapter in your life is you, the sports person, I suppose.
Yeah, sport is so, so important, and it should be a part of everybody's life, just because it offers so much. There is a sport out there for everyone, and there is literally, like I had this conversation with someone the other day, there is a sport out there for everyone. A lot of people get disheartened, they go along and try a sport, and they're like, oh, I don't enjoy it, or it's not for me. Another one is consistency. They don't commit to a sport for long enough before they then lose interest and unfortunately go, oh, sport is not for me. They've probably tried one or two things. There's hundreds of sports out there. And then they walk away from it and go, sport's not for me. Sport and fitness have been a massive part of my life for a number of reasons. It's given me focus and direction, something to look forward to. I enjoy pushing myself. I enjoy the elements of sport, so the competitiveness, learning new things. I said earlier that I'm a very kinesthetic person. Sport is very kinesthetic. It's very hands-on. There's a lot to learn about sport, so I love learning new things. So that's why sport interests me so much. But also sport, within sport, I enjoy helping others. I've got a thing for helping and supporting other people on a journey. And whether that's helping a teammate next to me or helping the new person that's rocked up to have a go at whatever sport I'm doing at the time, I really enjoy taking that time and that pleasure in supporting and helping somebody else into a sport. Sport just offers so much. And it keeps me fit and healthy. And we all know how important being fit and healthy is. I think, you know, taking it back to the time when I probably required that the most, when I got injured, was I probably recovered, I wouldn't say so well, but I recovered well and quickly from my injuries because of my fitness levels going into hospital. So that probably had a big, you know, a big influence on my recovery because of the fitness levels that I was, you know, I held before I went into hospital and I got injured. Sport is a massive thing, and will continue to be, and for as long as I can continue playing or being involved in sport, whilst also helping others, you know, get into sport as well.
Yeah, and absolutely wholeheartedly back that. When I look at what sport has done for my life, just this podcast, obviously, but it's given me my career. There are so many elements towards it. And kind of speaking about sport and the broader impact that it can have, and that brings us perfectly onto Invictus, I suppose. And we haven't touched on Invictus as a story yet on this show. Glad that we get to now, but being part of that in 2023, and the medals are, you know, success in itself, but I suppose being a part of that movement, essentially, meeting other people who have gone through something, I suppose, similar to yourself as well, and finding that camaraderie and comradeship again, was that sort of what it was like? I mean, what did that experience give you being a part of that this year?
Yeah, so the Invictus Games is just an amazing experience, an amazing journey. I actually wasn't going to apply for the Invictus Games because I didn't think it was for me. I didn't think I required it as part of my recovery journey. I had a few friends that had competed in previous games, and they said, "No, I think you should. I think, you know, being a sporting person, coming from a sport, you know, quite a big sporting background, yeah, I think it would do you really well." So I went away, had a look at it, did a bit of research, and obviously applied and went on to the games. And it's for those listeners that don't know what the Invictus Games is, you do, I think it's 9 or 10 pre-selection training camps, which gives those interested in going to the games the opportunity to go along to a training camp and have a go at a sport, whether that's a new sport, a sport that they used to enjoy pre-injury, or a sport that they're currently doing post-injury. So let's say, I don't know, they used to do cycling. They could come along and go do cycling and have a go at cycling. Or if they're now playing for a wheelchair basketball team post-injury, they can then go and have a go at playing wheelchair basketball for the Invictus Games. So that's what the build-up, the pre-selection training camps are. And then around Christmas time last year, so just before Christmas, if you wanted to go to the games and you were interested in continuing those sports moving forward, you could then apply to go to the Invictus Games and compete in those sports. So there was an application process. There was a number of questions and a 1-minute video that you had to submit. And unfortunately for me, I was selected to represent Team UK. And then in March this year, we went to team announcement, and 56 competitors out of almost 550 people that applied got selected to represent Team UK at this year's Invictus Games. So what then follows after team announcement is 12 training camps, which then gets the team together in the sports that you specified in competing in, and you do training camps specific to those sports ahead of the games. So I had initially chosen cycling because I used to cycle as an army triathlete, and I was keen to get back on a bike competitively again. Indoor rowing, and we'll come on to that a little bit more in a bit, but indoor rowing because of the journey that I've been through on a row machine. And wanted to progress that further. So a sort of a new sport, but something sort of there in the background. Archery, I had a go at archery at the pre-selection training camps, and it was a very technical sport, although not physically demanding, very technical. You had to be really, you know, self-controlled, breathing, really in the moment, you know, to take the shot. And I thought that was really cool, and I quite enjoyed it. So I was going to do archery and powerlifting. So, you know, I used to train in the gym. So I thought, hey, why not give it a go and have a go in a competitive environment? Never powerlifted competitively before. Unfortunately, powerlifting and archery conflicted with my two other sports. So I didn't do those. So I dropped those halfway through the training camps and then continued to do rowing and cycling. And then that led us up to the games, like you said, was in September of this year. But Invictus offers all of us something that we miss from the military. So a lot of us are connected through some form of sporting background anyway, but obviously we've all got the connection through the military, and we're all medically discharged, apart from they now, if you're on the wounded, injured and sick program whilst you're in the military, you can come as a serving personnel and still compete at the games. But it just allows you to reconnect with the things that you miss from the military. Like you said, that comradeship, that camaraderie, the banter, the humor and humility, all the things that you miss through the military, and almost taking a little bit of that element of what we spoke about earlier is sport offers so much similar to the military, is you're almost getting it through, you're getting all that stuff back through the military environment, through the sporting environment.
Mm-hmm.
But as military, ex-military personnel. So it all encompasses all that together. And then we went out to Dusseldorf in Germany, and we competed this year against 26 other nations. And Team UK did pretty well on the medals table. But yeah, it's an amazing opportunity for, you know, wounded, injured, sick serving and veteran military personnel to have that opportunity to get involved, to learn a new sport, rekindle the flame for an old sport, or continue to do a sport that they may have joined post-injury or upon leaving the military, but they can go and do it in a, you know, a bit more of a competitive environment, but still with that military twist in the background, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. Like I say, the idea of it and what it can give people, I think, has always been such a popular one. Now, has it kind of given you that, I don't know, that bug to want more? So we alluded to the Paralympic ambitions. I suppose is that, like I say, catching that bug, and like you mentioned about your personality, wanting that next challenge and wanting that next goal, and whether that is the next like real target, if you like, going forward.
So Invictus, the Invictus journey. Let's talk about rowing. So a rowing machine was just a piece of gym equipment beforehand. I did Brick in 2020, where I medal finished and got a British record, and thought there was some more to give. That then progressed to talking about applying for the Invictus Games and doing indoor rowing at the Invictus Games. And I thought this is a great opportunity to progress from doing the British Rowing Indoor Championships to maybe getting some proper coaching and developing my indoor rowing to then compete at the Invictus Games. So I thought, what a great opportunity. Whilst on that process, I came across a GB start coach who I had a brief conversation with, similar to what we're talking about now, and shared some of my splits and times from being on the rowing machine, having never had any formal coaching, you know, previously. And she said, wow, I think you really have got more to give. Like, let's see how you get on with the pre-training camps. And we can talk more about, you know, what more is to offer and where we can take this. So we continued to do that, and we had a chat, and I think she said, one of the things that we probably need to look at doing first is getting you classified. So classification for rowing is, or any sport, is done from the Paralympic side of things, is to classify your impairment against the international stage. So when you compete in world championships or events such as the Paralympics, you're on an even playing field with other people that have similar impairments in your classification. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, they don't classify. Their injuries don't fit within a classification with certain sports. And one of those for me was GB triathlon, para triathlon. I used to race to quite a high level in triathlon whilst I was in the military. I went along to Loughborough University a couple of years ago now, probably 2 years ago, to try and classify in GB triathlon. And fortunately, I think is the positive way to spin it, is I'm not disabled enough to race in para triathlon. My injuries aren't affected enough for me to race in that, and I've probably I'm probably too fit to be in that category in those classifications, which is only for the right reasons. I totally get that. So I went along taking it back to rowing. I went along at the start of this year. I think it was like February, March time. To get classified in British rowing or for British rowing. Mm-hmm. And I classify in the PR3 PI category. So PR3 is the category for impairments such as mine, a physical impairment, so a single limb physical impairment, someone with a single leg amputee, multiple sclerosis, all those sort of physical impairments, and then also alongside visually impaired people. Fit in that category. So as a person, they're able to compete in rowing physically, but obviously in a boat they can't see where they're going, so they would be paired with somebody, say like myself, and that's why they fit in that PR3 category. There are many others, but just off the some of the people that I've worked with and some of the people that I've competed with, those are the categories that fit into PR3. So I got classified as a PR3 athlete, and then carried on the Invictus journey. Alongside the Invictus journey, I also stepped in a boat for the first time, never been in a rowing boat ever. And at the end of March, end of May, beginning of June time this year, I sat in a rowing boat for the very first time and learned to row on the water. And that was another just amazing feeling of being out on the water, rowing, being out in the natural environment, just helps your mental health and well-being, as well as being physically demanding as well. So started to develop that alongside this Invictus journey. And then, like I said, went to the games. And just before the games, I got picked up by GB Rowing. I, through classification and the bits that I've been doing, I got, you know, reached out to by a GB talent pathway coach who wanted to explore, you know, what I'd been doing and what my splits were and what my times looked like on a row machine. So I went on the program with British Rowing on the pathway program for 12 weeks. And during that 12 week period, you do a number of workouts where you submit your scores and times to show what you're doing on a row machine. That finished just before the Invictus Games. And then went out to the Invictus Games, was overwhelmed to take gold in the men's 4 minute endurance row. And then on my return, went along to trial at Caversham, which is the home of British Rowing, to show what I can do live to the GB coaches, and to show my capabilities. And was, you know, I did quite well on the day. Could have done better, but I did well on the day. Enough to be selected to go on the world-class program, and to now be on the Paralympic Academy program to hopefully move forward to Paris Paralympics next year. Mm-hmm. So I'm training with the squad. I'll go away with the squad in a couple of weeks' time, 2 weeks' time. And then I've got a number of training camps in January and February ahead of another set of trials then, which will determine whether I go to Paris or not. But that's not the end of it. You know, that's not the end of the process. There's still LA in 2028. And I'm likely to hopefully stay on the program until LA in 2028. Mm-hmm. The only thing that's against me really, and that's not a negative phrase, you know, it's a true fact, is that I only started rowing in sort of May, June time this year. You know, I've never been in a boat before, whereas I'm potentially against people who have an impairment, have had an impairment for a lot longer than me, and have also spent a lot more time in a boat, many more years in a boat than me. So they're technically better at rowing than I am. So it's an amazing privilege to be on the Academy program, to have sights on Paris Paralympics next year, and to wear, or soon to wear, a uniform again that's got the Union flag.
Yeah.
On the chest and represent the country. It's just, you know, amazing. I have to still pinch myself to go, wow, this is actually real and this is pretty cool. But yeah, no, that's the journey in a nutshell. And, you know, it's been amazing. And part of those little bits are, you know, the likes of Brick yesterday, I was there representing British Rowing and the PR3 and the PR3 contingent, and yeah, exciting times. So, you know, really, really excited to see what happens. Lots of training going in. I'm doing 15, 16 sessions a week. Some days I'm doing 3 or 4 sessions a day. Lots of time on the water, just building up that rowing technical knowledge, as well as my physical feeling and knowledge of being in a boat and what it should feel like and how connected I should be and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's really going back to that point I was saying earlier, I'm a kinesthetic learner. It's hands-on. I'm learning a new thing. Every day is different. And it's just it's a pretty cool environment.
Definitely. And you touched on it as well. This is all really, really recent stuff. Of having been in that boat that first time, that type of thing. Is there a sense that, obviously you're still relatively new to it all, that you're still, I don't know, finding that feeling of belonging within that rowing community? Or is that something that's come relatively quickly, or something you're still kind of getting to grips with, that this is where you are now on your journey?
No, I think it's still something I'm definitely getting to grips with. You know, I'm not only just learning a new sport, I'm learning about a new community of people. I've never been in the rowing community before. And all I can say at the moment is it's all positive. You know, the community is fantastic. every rowing club I've been in or been under or been coached by have just been so supportive and so helpful along the way. Everyone I meet at the club, regardless of whether you know them or not, or you've seen them before, everyone says hello, everyone takes a moment to talk to you. And then if you dive that down even more, when you take that into sort of the injured community or the impaired community in rowing, you know, I was at Caversham for trials a couple of weeks ago, and you know, you got Paralympians coming to sit with you at the breakfast table, and just take the time to come and chat with you, and you know, and that's amazing, and that's really touching. So yeah, I'm still learning, I'm still developing, I'm still giving it all I can, because it's an amazing opportunity. It is literally a once in a lifetime opportunity to be in this position. So you know, I'm gonna embrace it for all that it's got, and make the most of the opportunity. But yeah, I'm still learning, still finding my feet. I would like to be there on the podium at Paris next year with a medal around my chest and that union flag on my chest or on my arm, representing the country again, but in a different way. And along that journey, sharing that, you know, adversity happens, adversity is difficult, but it's how you deal with it and how you come out the other side. There's still plenty of opportunity for you at the end of the day. There's still great things to go on and do. It's not doom and gloom at the end of the day, but it's about how you sort of grab the bull by the horns and take it for a ride, really, and really sort of embrace what opportunities are there and explore those opportunities. Yeah. So
does that almost feel like your purpose now, to almost shining that light and say going away from that doom and gloom, not just for yourself, but obviously with the charity work that you do, but for others as well?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You know, I've become an advocate for mental health. Mental health is so important. But I've also become an advocate from a sports perspective. You know, I encourage anyone, regardless of injury or illness, to go out and have a go at sport. Because sport, we've already alluded to it, but sport offers us so much. But it's the fitness side of things as well that we get from sport. But yeah, no, definitely. I think that's become part of my role. And if, I don't know, again, this is not a negative statement, but if I don't make Paris, I've had an amazing journey. And if unfortunately I don't make LA for whatever reason, hopefully the journey that I have been on, I could impact a couple of people along the way. And maybe one of those people would eventually, you know, come through the program and go on to do the Paralympics at some point in the future. And that I'll be made up for that if someone, you know, got in touch with me in the future and went, you encouraged me into a rowing boat or onto a bike, and I'm now going to the Paralympics in however many years' time. You know, that would be really amazing. And I do find that people reach out to me through social media, friends and, you know, members of the public that are connected with me, just to say, you know, from what you're sharing and from what you're doing and what you're talking about has helped me, and has helped me move forward or get out of a rut or seek help. And that just really is the, you know, I don't know, the icing on the cake for me, really. Helping and supporting other people is just, it just makes me get out of bed every day.
Yeah.
You know, it is amazing, and the impact that I can have on somebody else. And yes, I've been through a lot of crap to get to the stage where I am today, but it makes me better. So even if I had nothing to look forward to, if I didn't have the Paralympics, if I didn't do rowing, if I just did fitness, I went to the gym and I did a bit of work, but every day I knew I'd got up and I could share a post that would help someone, or do a talk that would help someone, or have an interview or do a podcast like this and it could help someone, that's made my day, that's fulfilled my day for me, because I'm helping someone else get better through sharing my journey and what I've been through. So I think that's definitely become part of my journey, and I would like to continue that moving forward and continue to be an advocate for mental health and well-being, but also for physical health as well. And that doesn't have to be people that are impaired, doesn't have to be people that are disabled. it could just be people, you know, that are, you know, that have had an accident or are running a bit ill for a couple of days or whatever it may be. But just to get them out of that negative environment, to get them feeling positive again and feeling motivated and driven. And that's what this all gives me as well. It gives me purpose, it gives me direction, and it gives me focus during these, you know, well, following quite a difficult period of my life. So yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. And that's like a perfect time to mention as well that you are an ambassador for our charity partner, the Mintridge Foundation. Obviously, no secret for long-time listeners of the show how much we value the work that that organisation does supporting young people through sport in so many ways, be it life skills, be it confidence, whatever it might be. And I say that's another avenue for you now to try and have that impact and I suppose be the voice to young people that maybe you would have liked at that stage in your life as well.
Yeah, definitely. It was a privilege when Mintridge reached out to me, and they again through my social media were connected and expressed that they'd love me to be on board as an ambassador. And when I delved into who was already ambassadors for Mintridge, I was a bit overwhelmed with the Olympians and Paralympians that were already part of the sort of list of people that were ambassadors. But I, you know, when I spoke to Alex, and you know, I was very privileged to be picked up and asked, and yeah, to have that impact and on especially young people. You know, you look back at my childhood, and I would have been over the moon for someone like me to stand in front of the class or me as an individual and go like, this is what I've done in my life. Don't do this because of X, Y, and Z. You know, adversity is normal. You're going to experience some negativity, but it's about how you deal with it. And actually, by one of the ways of dealing with it is getting into sport at a young age and having that sporting background to support. You know, sport is away from your family life. It builds friends and connections, potentially for life as well. You can make friends in sport from a young age for life. And it gives you so many prospects to move forward. But yes, to have the opportunity to join Mintridge and to become an ambassador and to focus on speaking to young children and sharing my story and putting a bit of a spin on it to help them. But then to also be asked to become a mentor as well and take on young children and mentor them through a number of weeks or months for a program to help them develop through, you know, quite difficult times in their lives when you're dealing with, you know, normal things such as GCSEs, adolescence, growing up, all the things that childhood offers us. And often some of those are also faced with, you know, parents that have got disabilities or illnesses or maybe unfortunately have passed away. And they're dealing with all of that stuff at the same time of such a vital point in their life. To have someone there that's, you know, not part of your family, so that, you know, they can listen and take in and help you understand what's going on, and not from the school that's not gonna, you know, not gonna impact you whilst you're at school and is impartial to all of that, to help you focus and set goals and move forward is, you know, is amazing. So yeah, I'm thankful to Mintridge for reaching out, because the opportunities that they've given me to give to other people is amazing.
Yeah, definitely. And shows the power of having that voice in your corner, ultimately. And as I've often said, only Alex Wallace has convinced me to do 2 half marathons. So she is an incredible woman. And that charity does do amazing, amazing things.
Yeah.
Kind of round this off, do you have, I suppose, a key bit of advice from your own personal journey, your own learnings, for those who might be listening that are going through their own difficulties, whether it's severe trauma or, like I say, advocate for mental health now, and that is such a big issue at the moment, particularly after, I suppose, the years that we have been through as a society, and I suppose what your key message would be to people who find themselves in that situation?
I think we've already covered bits of it throughout the talk, but definitely is we're allowed a bad day. It's normal to have a down day, to have a bad day, but don't let that bad day or down day continue into the next and the next and the next, and then it becomes weeks and months, and it can spiral. So if you are going through that, please seek help. And there are so many charities and agencies out there to support you and your family through adversity and struggle, to help you come out the other side in a much better place. And then the other one is, which we covered a little bit earlier, is you are the captain of your destiny. So whether you are in a bad job or you're going through a bad spell in your life, you control that. Don't wait for someone else to come along and go, oh, by the way, hit the next bus stop's over here, so come and jump on the bus over this way. You've got to go find that bus stop and get on the bus. So take control of your life. There is plenty of time in the day to, you know, to change things around and fit in some fitness if you can. And I encourage anyone that doesn't do fitness as part of their, you know, daily or weekly routine to try and get some fitness in there, whether it's a, you know, a walk or a jog or some time at the gym or a sport, you know, go and find a sport at a local club. But going back to the point is, you are in control of your destiny. So if you're not happy, change it. You know, if you're not having a good time, if work's not good, if it's that mundane cycle that you're constantly not looking forward to getting up the next morning to go and embrace the next day, then that's down to you to change. So change it and make those changes, because no one else is going to do it for you. I think that's probably the biggest two that I would share is,
And I say perfect messages. How often do we say it's okay not to be okay? And that message does ring true a lot of the time. And just accepting that that's okay is a large part, I think, of moving forwards. Thank you so much for your time today, Ben. Like I say, lots of, I think, key, powerful notes and messages that people can take away, but also just hearing your story first time. I think you can read about it as much as you like, but to actually hear it from yourself and what you've been through, and to talk about your own, to hear you talking about your own personal journey in that way, and as I keep, you know, referencing, in a relatively short space of time, I think is so remarkable. So huge kudos to yourself and what you're ultimately doing to give back to people as well is so, so positive. And fingers crossed that that Paralympic dream does turn out to be true, because I think you'll have endless amounts of people backing you should that Paris 2024 dream come true. But yeah, thank you so much for sharing your story, and we wish you well in the near future.
No, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on. And it's always good, like you say, to be able to talk and share my story during a conversation rather than someone going to my website to read it or whatever it may be. So, it's a privilege to come on and share my story and taking the opportunity to talk to you. So thanks again.
A huge thank you to Ben for coming onto the podcast, and to our charity partners, the Mintridge Foundation, for helping to make this episode happen. I think we can all agree just how remarkable Ben is as an individual, and anyone can take something positive from his messages within that. That is almost it for this episode of the podcast. If you liked what you heard, then please give us a like on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. And all of our handles are at SportsfieldPod. We'd also love it if you could subscribe to the show on the podcast platform of your choice. You can also catch all of our episodes and content on our website. That is SportsfieldOnline.com. That's it for this week, everyone. You can catch us next week with another episode. This time our guest is racing driver Isla McKenzie. Until then, have a good week. And goodbye.